Johnny Dubb is an award-winning photographer from Manchester, UK, now based in Tokyo. His photographic journey began amid the bustling streets of Tokyo, where he skillfully captured and continues to capture everyday life. Johnny's evocative work has garnered acclaim, establishing him as a prominent figure to watch out for in the realm of contemporary street photography. Welcome to the Street Photography Show, Johnny. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here talking with you.
Offline, we were discussing the fact that you have just been featured in a book, a 7-page spread, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
That's correct, yeah. It's in the latest issue of Silver Grain Classics, which is an analog photography magazine. It's a quarterly magazine that it's run out of, printed out in Germany, and it's distributed worldwide. You can get it from silvergrainclassics.com. And yeah, the main article of this is with Steve McCurry, and there's a few other featured articles, but every issue they will do artists or photographers as kind of showcases, I guess. And they actually reached out to me through Facebook. It was through a Facebook group. I'd shared some photos, and one of the editors there actually got in touch, and they said, "We love your work. We love how you kind of show," because I'm based out in Tokyo, and it's a lot of just kind of night street shots and people and characters and things like that. They just really loved how I captured people of the city and asked if I'd be willing to have my photos in the magazine and a little interview. And I said, of course, I'd absolutely be more than honoured to be featured. And that came out it's the latest issue. It runs every quarter. So that was a really nice kind of end to 2023 to get that feature in there. So I'm still waiting on my copy though. So I'll be happy when it arrives. And I can actually look at it in print.
There's nothing more exhilarating than having your work featured or printed or published. It's such a rush.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because prior to this, I mean, I have the first work that I published, I self-published a zine, which was I created 100 copies of a zine. It was called Kaiko. And Kaiko is Japanese for retrospective. And it was basically just a retrospective look at my first kind of 4 years of photography. There was no theme to the work other than it was just a load of images that I'd taken that I self-published. And I remember when the actual magazines arrived, and I was unboxing them. It was amazing to just see a collection of your work in a print format. I think today we live in this kind of digital age, and so many people take photos and have never printed their work either through, a home printer or a professional printer to go on the wall or to go into a magazine or whatever. So many people just kind of, they view photos online and, on their phone and stuff. And it's a very different experience when you actually see a physical print of something. It is, like you say, it's a rush, it's a real rush. And also for me, like when, I'm somebody who I guess historically has kind of dealt with a bit of, what do they call it, imposter syndrome, Like I guess I'm my own worst critic, and there's a big community of photographers in Tokyo and, globally. I guess, people are connected these days, and so many of my peers, I look at their work, is so fantastic, so the standards I kind of compare myself to are quite high. So I always kind of feel like, it's not, I'll look at it and go, that's all right. And then 2 days later, I'll be like, it's a load of garbage. And it's kind of nice when somebody else then comes forward and says, oh no, we like what you're doing. We think it's great. And it's a encouraging thing to have, that it makes you kind of think, oh, maybe I shouldn't be so tough on myself, with my work. And it's not as bad as I think it is.
When did you first pick up the camera? And I mean, how did it all start for you?
I guess there's two sides to it, really. I mean, I would say really it was when I moved to Japan. That was when I properly started. I was kind of inspired by the city and the people, and so this was 5 years ago or thereabouts. Although I didn't really take to it straight away. I got myself a Sony camera and it just didn't really gel with it. And then I ended up buying a Fujifilm, sold it all and got a Fujifilm. And really that really kind of kickstarted my love. I just found it just way more fun and interesting running around with that camera. So I guess it was like when I moved to Japan, but actually it's kind of like photography has been a part of my life since I was born, basically, because my father's a photographer. He's an advertising photographer and a commercial photographer. So I actually grew up in studios and things like that. He had a big studio in Manchester in the UK, where I'm from originally. And, I was loading Mamiya RB67 backs, when I was a kid, helping out in the studio. I'd be moving lights and tidying up and looking through loops and things. So I grew up in that environment, but I didn't like it. I didn't find it in any way interesting at all, because I think that my dad, he would do all the creative stuff. And because I ended up helping him out as I got a little bit older, you know, a teenager and whatever, for some pocket money. And I would just do painting the sets and cleaning and making teas for the clients and all that kind of stuff, and didn't have any like creative input. So I found it very boring, you know. And if anything, I'd say it even put me off photography. But I guess, as they say, you know, the apple didn't fall far from the tree in the end. And once I kind of found my own niche, you know, I just took to it.
I'm assuming you're still using the Fuji camera today. And if you are, what model are you using?
So I was using the X-Pro 3 and I had the X100F, but I ended up selling those. I've now got a Leica M11P, which I picked up recently. And I've got loads of film cameras. I've got like a Leica M3 and an MP, the film cameras. Plus I've got some medium format cameras. I've got quite a collection now, really, of things. I do have a Sony now again, because I wanted something. I have different cameras for different reasons. For example, the Sony, some of the shots that I like to do for like events and festivals, I like to get very close with like a 14mm lens and off-camera flash, use some slow shutter and get like real dynamic photos, which you can't do with the Leica cameras because of the close focusing is, because it's a rangefinder, the closest focusing is 70 centimeters. So there's certain shots that it's almost impossible to do with Leica. So I had to have a different setup for that. So I still do have one Fujifilm camera, but I'm actually probably going to sell it at some point, because it just doesn't get any use. So yeah, the Fujifilms are an amazing brand, and it's great that they get the kind of recognition that they do now, because I think because of the way they're designed, they're very tactile. And for someone like me, who kind of grew up in had that analog childhood, you know, buttons and switches, and I'm not somebody who uses menus. I like to have manual control of things, and that's what the Fujifilm brings, which is also similarly with the Leica. You know, that's why I gravitated to the Leica, apart from the image quality.
Funny enough, Nikon's doing that too. Nikon's moving towards switches and dials.
Yeah, I think, you know, people respond to that. I mean, there's, you know, the Sony is the kind of opposite. I mean, it's the menus and the buttons and everything that they've got on there. It's so deep. And I mean, Sony get a lot of hate for their cameras. People either love them or hate them. And, you know, they do take great images, but at the same time, it's like the camera literally does all the work. Like if you've got the latest Sony camera and you can't take good photos with it, then that's a you problem. It's not a camera problem. You know, it's like that camera is designed to basically take great photos no matter what. And, you know, with the Fujifilm ones and with the Leicas, where it's more manual control to work to get your photos, you have to understand photography, you have to understand the principles of how a camera works, of, you know, the exposure triangles, and you have to really, my analogy I use, I guess it's like, you know, the difference between driving an automatic and a manual car. You know, they'll both get you there, but one of them you're way more in tune with and in control of what you're doing.
I agree with you. There's, you know, those menus, I mean, they can be frustrating at times too. I've never owned one of the top tier Sonys. I've had a Sony, but it was a point and shoot, so I don't think it's the same thing, but I have heard of people not particularly liking those menus that you have, you know, that you have to deep dive into. It's more of a nuisance than anything.
It is.
Because what I use an Olympus setup.
Nice. Yeah.
I mean, it does the job. I like it because, you know what? It's what I've got, number one, and I'm too cheap to go spending money on cameras. And I like the glass. I like the primes that I have.
Yeah, Olympus is great.
Their menu system, I would say, is pretty involved as well. I guess with time, I just got used to them because I've had these two cameras now for about almost 10 years. And I mean, they're old. They're like the first generation ones, but they still take great pictures. And I, like I said, because I'm cheap, I have no interest in upgrading because for me, it's all about the glass.
Yeah, 100%. The saying is, isn't it, like you date the body, you marry the glass.
Right, exactly. I have digital SLRs still. Like, really, the only mirrorless cameras I have are those two Olympus bodies. I do have two Nikon bodies. They're DSLRs. And to be honest with you, I'm really not interested in upgrading. I mean, those cameras are still working. They still give me what I want in terms of image quality. And, I mean, I even have, like, Canon's. I have an SL2. I don't know if you know that camera. It's a very inexpensive DSLR. It's a APS-C camera. But the only reason why I kept it is because I have the Sigma 18-35 1.8. With, you know, they call that the bag of primes.
Yeah, yeah.
That lens is phenomenally sharp. That's the only reason why I have that camera, because that lens lives on that camera.
So it's a whole big separate conversation, really, isn't it? You know, kind of the gas syndrome and the, you know, does gear matter and all this kind of stuff. And I know, like, my dad, for example, like, he still shoots with a Canon, I think it's one of the 5Ds, and he was always of the opinion where, for him, it's just a tool. It doesn't really care. As long as it does the job that he needs, he knows that setup inside out, because he's been using, well, he used to shoot film back in the day, but when he moved over to digital, he moved over to Canon, so he's been with that setup and he knows it like the back of his hand. But for what he needs, he's happy with that. Now, I'm kind of somebody that I was always a bit of a collector. I used to collect, you know, synthesizers years ago when I was involved in music, and I was a record collector, and when I got into photography, for me, part of the enjoyment is the gear. I do actually like the gear, and it doesn't have to be the latest and greatest all the time, but I like to try things out. You know, I'm not somebody who's like, I don't have a particular like fixed brand loyalty to any brand. I just like trying things out, and some, you know, you can buy it and you can sell it, and you know, it's kind of quite transient how I go through my equipment. And I'm just lucky that I have a full-time job and a very understanding wife basically
that always helps, right?
Yeah but it's definitely, it's, you know, it's, I think as well, like I was saying before, I think today the equipment now is getting so good that you can't not take great photos with a lot of this modern gear. But one of the things when I really started getting into photography, and street photography particularly, and I started to study it as an art form, you know, when you're getting into something like that, you look back at the masters, you look at the work of the greats, and you see, you know, and when you see what gear they used back in the day, and obviously they didn't have all the bells and whistles, they didn't have the IBIS, they didn't have, you know, 160 frames a second or whatever, you know, they were shooting film, you know, the limitations of film, all manual focus, everything like that. And you're looking at this work and I'm thinking, if they can take great photos like that with the limitations of the gear that they were using, then there's no reason that, I'm not saying that I would ever be able to take great photos like that, but it's like, in my mind was thinking, well, if that's achievable with that, then all this extra stuff is superfluous. You know, I need to learn the basics, the fundamentals of photography, how to master light and composition, subject matter, learn the exposure triangle, get off automatic mode, get off aperture priority mode, and figure out actually how to take a good photo. So the first thing I did at that point was I went out and I bought the most bare bones film, I think it was a Pentax Spotmatic F, which is just a fully manual film camera, you know, which is just, there's absolutely nothing to it other than your most basic controls. And I went and shot with that for a while, and to understand how film work, how light work, how composition works, how that exposure triangle work, how the camera settings kind of relate to one another in order to achieve the image that you want to achieve. And I think that that's something that today people often overlook, because it's so easy to just go and get a great camera that people get so fixated on pixel count and, you know, sharpness and, you know, file megapixel file size, you know, oh, this is 100 megapixel file. Well, this doesn't matter if you can't take a good photo with it.
You mentioned the greats, right? Like Henri Cartier-Bresson. He was never big on sharpness. He didn't care about sharpness.
No, of course he didn't. No.
In his interviews, he said that flat out.
Same with Daido Moriyama out in Japan. You know, he's obviously that kind of the most famous Japanese photographer, who was certainly from the school of Bresson. And for me, it's like when I think of Tokyo photography, Japanese style photography, he kind of wrote the book on it, and it's that very quick, almost grainy, you know, doesn't care about sharpness, doesn't care about it's funny, if you actually meet a lot of the kind of slightly older generation Japanese photographers who are somewhat successful, and you know, they all going around with the most basic point and shoot camera, like they don't care about that, it's about capturing the moment.
Yeah, they don't care. Well, this goes back to our point, you know, kind of like what you said about your father, right? That it was just a tool.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
I think a lot of these legends that we refer to them as back in the day, like the Winograd Grands and the Bressons and, you know, the Vivian Myers, they looked at the camera as just a tool. That's it.
Yeah, exactly.
It was all about image taking. That's what it was about. And it was about creating art and recording and documenting. And that's what street photography really is at its core.
Yeah, 100%. And also when you have these kind of limitations old analog gear provides, you know, it's like, if you can't just change the ISO because it's fixed on your film, you know, it's you can't go out shooting at f1.0 because those lenses didn't exist back then, you know? So the limitations of the camera mean that you have to get very creative with how you use that in order to get the shots that you want in any kind of conditions, you know? I think it's a really good approach to simplify the actual technical process. Once you understand the rules, you can learn how to break them. And I think part of the problem today is this: people kind of almost like try to break the rules of photography without actually knowing what it is that they're breaking or what it is that they're doing. And I'm certainly no expert in it all, you know. I definitely consider myself a student rather than any kind of teacher of photography, you know. It's a constant learning process for me.
I'll be honest with you, I've been shooting since the 80s, and I still consider myself learning. I wouldn't consider myself a great by any means, by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, I do enjoy it. And I can say, though, confidently that I do know a lot of the photography rules because I grew up from that train of thought. You know, I grew up in a time when we didn't have the internet. You know, I had magazines. I had people that I would look up to. I mean, you were even more lucky because you had your father to learn from, right? My father was not a photographer. My father was far from it, actually. But, you know, I had other sources of inspiration. I remember in the 90s, I was part of photography clubs, you know, camera clubs that we would get together and we would talk about our work and, you know, and gear and all that stuff. I mean, this was a time before the internet even came into existence and before we had all the resources that we have today, because it's like you said before, nowadays you can anybody can take a damn picture, you know. It's pretty dummy proof with the cameras that we have available to us and all the resources,
especially with the you know, computational photography that's, you know, through mobile phones and things like that. You know, for most people, they will get a better photo using a phone than they will a professional DSLR camera, because, you know, the phone will be able to do things that a camera can't because of the limitations on dynamic range with the camera. A phone can use computational photography to get around that, so it can adjust to make sure that the sky is exposed and you who stood in the shadow is exposed. Whereas where if you're using a camera, you have to pick one or the other. You know, if you're bright day and you stood in the shade, are you going to overexpose the highlights to get you an exposure, or are you going to be too dark to see? Whereas computational photography takes that out of the equation, because it will just take multiple exposures and create the best composition using a combination of those things. And that's where it's become idiot proof. But then at the same time, like, there's no creative thought process that goes on there, because the limitations of what cameras are able to do means that you can get very creative with it. Because a camera doesn't see like the eye sees, it means that, and it has a much smaller dynamic range, it means it can show the world in a way that we can't see it with our own eyes. And that's a very beautiful thing to be able to do, to use the limitations of the equipment to create a vision and to create imagery that shows how we'd like to interpret the world. You know, for example, like, you know, high contrast photography, the human eye doesn't see the world like that. Modern smartphone cameras won't record it like that either, you know, unless you actually manually put it in. But with that, you can do it with cameras, and I think that's an awesome thing.
You moved to Tokyo 5 years ago, which I'm assuming then that was like around COVID time.
Before COVID, yeah.
You know, and you've been there ever since, and that's really when, like you said, you started. I'm just curious. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, Tokyo is a mecca, if you will, for street photography.
Yes.
Much like what New York City would be to some.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of people say NYC is a mecca, and I've shot in New York City, and I can tell you that it is phenomenal. Heard like Tokyo is like the New York across the pond.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that? And also, like, when you started walking the streets of Tokyo, what were your first impressions? I mean, what kind of sources of inspiration did you draw from? How did you learn? How did you approach it?
So there's a couple of things to talk about. First, the kind of question of the statement of Tokyo being like the New York of Asia, I guess. And I certainly would agree that it's perceived like that. However, I would also say that it's very, very, very different. For me, I'd actually say that somewhere like Hong Kong is probably a little bit more the kind of New York of Asia, because Tokyo's very clinical in a way that New York isn't. Hong Kong still has a bit of grit about it, you know. The people on the street are a little bit more lively and animated. But, you know, I do totally understand why people, you know, the comparison, because a lot of people, you know, when you think of street photo mecca destinations, you've kind of got India as a whole. Everybody wants to go shoot India, New York, Tokyo, you know, London, maybe another one. But these are always in the conversation. And I think the thing about Tokyo is because you have, there's not many major, well, firstly, there's no major cities on the scale of what Tokyo is. But secondly, like, there's not many major cities that have the balance of the old and the new so intertwined, and have the kind of relentlessness of the city, in terms of, like, the minute you go out your door, there's a million people every which way you look. There's just this 24-hour driving energy that exists in Tokyo, and you can go out anywhere, any time of the day. And also, and it's very safe. So for photographers, it's great, because you can go out, you can get very close with the camera. You know, there's so many people, there's so much energy and activity here. It almost feels like a playground to run around with the camera, you know, provided you're respectful of the people. You know, it's like, we're not here to make people look bad or abuse the culture and the kindness of people out here. You have to still treat with respect and dignity and stuff. But you can get away with things here that in other cities around the world, you'd probably get your camera wrapped around your head for trying, you know, if that makes sense. So in terms of the second part of the questions that you asked about sources of inspiration, I always find it quite difficult to answer, because I don't really know. You know, I was very inspired by the city. I'd never lived, you know, Manchester's a very small city compared to Tokyo. And so being in this new culture, in this new environment, in this huge city where everything's exciting to me, everything's new and exciting, and architecture is interesting, and, you know, the way people dress and the way people move is interesting to me, the amount of people, you know, so I was just inspired to take it all in. I guess, like, I started off, the images I started taking were kind of more streets, were more like street snap pics, you know, like, they weren't creative in any way. I would often keep my distance, and I guess the more I started to learn about photography and also looking at the work of, like, Japanese photographers and Asian photographers and other, you know, esteemed photographers, and learning about what is street photography, you know, what as an art form, I became more brave with my work and would start to get closer to people and all that kind of stuff. You know, if I look back at my early work when I was over here, and it was very much staying far away and trying to find nice competitions, whereas a lot of the stuff I do today is kind of more about trying to capture the energy of the city. And I think that's probably one of the things that really inspires me. It's the energy of the place.
Well, it's kind of funny. I've always spoken with people that have said a few things to me. And, you know, when they started in photography, and just recently it's been because of COVID, right? So, you know, there's typically the two answers I'll get is, you know, I started photography because I went somewhere beautiful and I wanted to absorb it. I wanted to capture it. And then I just got hooked on photography. That's one thing I hear a lot of. And you kind of said that, right? You went there, you wanted to absorb it. You started clicking snaps, as you called them. And, you know, that's what happens with a lot of people. They start picking up a camera, they start taking pictures of this new place that they've discovered, and they're like, oh my gosh, look at these images, and they keep going.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you got the other people who are gearheads. They get into photography because they are fascinated by gear. And, you know, there's that class of photographer. And now, just more recently, I guess you could say, is people have gotten into photography because of COVID. I mean, I've already spoken with a few people here on the show that started because of COVID. Like, oh, you know, I was bored, I was twiddling my thumbs at home. I didn't know what to do. I was going stir crazy. So guess what? I picked up my phone, or I dusted off that old camera in the closet, and I went for a walk. It's kind of funny, you know, and I can definitely see from your Instagram feed that you definitely soaked it in, right? And you continue to soak it in. I mean, see, when I reached out to you, I was looking at your Instagram feed, and I thought, the first thing that I thought was, wow, look at all this culture. Like, he's really capturing the culture of where he lives.
Thank you. That's very kind of you to say.
Well, it's true, though. You know, I mean, you really are capturing the culture of where you live, and you do it in a way that, yes, artistically, creatively, even technically, in some respects, with some of these images, I mean, they're very telling. And I've always said it, and this is something that, you know, if any of my listeners are listening to the show for a while, they'll know that I'm all about storytelling. And I feel that a good image is a story first and foremost. You know, some people will say, oh, it's about chasing light, it's this and that, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with those answers. But for me, it's always the story first.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny, I was with, there's a photographer from New York who was visiting Tokyo just last week. His artist name is Stockeasy, and he's pretty successful photographer. He does commercial work, but also does street work. And we were talking, and he asked me, he said, you know, I ask everybody the same question, but he says, where in order of importance when it comes to taking a photo, what order do you put these in? And he said, lighting, composition, and subject. And I said, well, obviously it's subject first, because without, that's your story. Without the story, there is, you know, there's no, you know, that's the meat and bones of the photo. That's the interest. And then you've got your composition, because your composition is what frames your subject. You know, that's how, you know, that gives it a setting and a place and a time, you know, and it gives it more detail to the story. And then you've got your lighting at the end, and the lighting will make whatever it is that you're taking more beautiful. It's like the fairy dust at the end.
It's like Henri Cartier-Bresson said, light is like perfume.
Exactly.
It's the icing on the cake, if you will.
No, absolutely. You know, great lighting will elevate a composition. But, you know, if you have a bad composition and no subject, no amount of lighting is going to make that a good photo. You can't just go take a photo of light and call it a good photo. That is the, you know, like you say, that's your perfume at the end of the day. So I think that subject, you know, whenever you see a photo that grabs your attention, it's the subject. That's the first thing that's going to jump out at you. The point of interest that makes you go, wow, that's a great photo. You know, that puts that moment in your mind where you start to question what's going on there, and who's that person, and you know, all this kind of stuff. And like, so subject is definitely your most important part of any photo, I think, anyway, you know, for sure.
When you started photographing the streets of Tokyo, do you think by taking your camera out on these walks and photographing your new environment, do you think it's helped you draw closer to the people and to the culture and to and frankly, to your new home?
Yes, 100%. And what's kind of, actually, I would even go one step further than that. And I'd say one of the things that really did was actually start using flash in my work. And it's a weird thing, because I think flash is quite a polarizing thing for people to use in photography, you know, especially street photography. Some people are like, are for it, some people don't mind it, some people are adamantly against it. And I always felt that before, when I first started taking photos, particularly where people were the subject, and I was trying to, like, it always felt like I was trying to steal a photo, you know, like I'd try and take a photo without getting spotted, and, you know, try and always be like this invisible character, to, you know, lurking in the shadows taking photos. And to me, it felt quite dishonest in some respects. And I know it's not necessarily the case, and others would disagree that that's not how they feel, and I'm not saying that that is the right or wrong, but it's kind of how it felt to me. When I started to use flash, I was making it very clear that I've just taken somebody's photo. And also what would happen is then we would often strike up a discussion afterwards. We'd have a talk, we'd have a laugh. I'm very playful when I go on, when I'm taking photos using flash. And for me, it made me connect with people and the environment in a way that I hadn't done before. Because it, like I say, you know, we particularly like COVID and post-COVID times, people have got themselves into this little their own little isolation bubbles, you know. And for people, it was difficult coming back out of that. And for me, it's like, it's an instant kind of conversation starting. You know, you take somebody's photo and they, for a moment, you're just like pulling them out of whatever train of thought they're in, and they're a bit confused. And then you quickly have a conversation with them. You say, oh, you look amazing. Yeah, I love your outfit, and you look so great stood there in the light. And instantly you've got a little connection there. So for me, it was like, definitely, like, photography was a way for me to see the world, but also to interact with people through using flash work as well, which, you know, and I think, and like I say, I think it's a shame that flash does get a bit of a bad rep, because it's not always a bad thing. You know, it can be done very, you know, pleasantly, and can be a very joyful experience for the people involved, you know.
It's interesting that you say that it's allowed you to connect with people, because one thing I see in your work, and it makes me wonder, and I'll get to it in a second, but when I look at your work, I definitely see that there is a lot of interaction with people. I can see that. You're not shy. You are going up to people. And I guess my question is this: are you the kind of photographer that, you know, do you try to get more candid? Do you try to approach people and ask for their picture? How do you do that? Because obviously it's apparent in your work that you have no problem going up to people. I can see that. Okay. You know, so some people would say, oh, I'm an introvert. I'm very shy, but I don't sense that with you.
No, not at all.
What's your process when you're, you know, when you're eyeballing someone and you're like, do I want to take this individual's picture? Because there are some shots here that are, they're in the moment and they're like, you know, I can see you didn't ask for their permission. And then there are others that are more staged. And what I mean by that is their portraiture. How do you approach each individual? What goes through your mind before you decide to take that picture?
It depends, really. I mean, like I say, it's, you know, I'm certainly somebody who likes to kind of more capture a moment than, you know, stage it, for example. Like, I find that the minute you ask the question, kind of take the photo, it turns into something very different. You know, it becomes them, oh, I'll pose, or, you know, in Japan, often they'll put up the peace sign, you know, they put up the V's at you and stuff. And, you know, I never really liked that. I mean, more recently, I actually started trying street portraiture, you know, where I would actually stop and ask people to take the photo. As, you know, because I don't like to just get stuck in a one way of doing things. I'm trying to learn and get better, so I want to try all these things. But for me, most of the time, it's everything's reactionary. You know, you'll see somebody, or you'll see a bit of light and somebody walking through it, and you've got one split second. You don't even have time to think. You just take the photo. You know, like I say, it's like I'm somebody who will. I'm not somebody who will take a photo, and if somebody gets upset, will be like, oh well, it's my right to take this photo. You know, I'm not out there to upset people or anything. And like I say, I'm very, very playful, and like after I take somebody's photo, I'll talk to them and explain why I took the photo, you know. But generally speaking, I prefer to kind of try and get my favorite photos are the moment where, like, you're just pulling somebody into the moment as well, you know. They're walking along, they're thinking about what they're going to have for their dinner that night, and all of a sudden they see someone and they kind of look up, and you're just catching that moment of almost, it's not shock or surprise or anything, it's just a moment of what's going on in their, you know, a look in their face. And I like that because it's quite expressive and it's quite dynamic. But like I said, you know, people will often assume that when they see images like that, that there's a negative attached to that, when, like I say, more often than not, there isn't. 99% of the time that I take photos of people, we end up laughing afterwards and talking, and it's generally fun. And occasionally, you know, you will get somebody who'll be like, why did you take my photo, can you delete that or whatever, which again, it's absolutely fine, there's no issues to that. And I would actually say that I had more instances of people getting upset with me taking photos of them when I didn't use flash, interestingly enough, because people thought there was something kind of, yeah, creepy, like, why are you trying to take my photo without me knowing, you know. But ultimately, I do think that, you know, firstly, like, there's no you're not hurting anybody doing this. And like I say, we're not trying to go out there and upset people. Like, so if somebody, I may have taken somebody's photo, and if they genuinely, they don't want me to do it, then I'll delete it. Like I say, I don't want to upset or offend anybody. But at the same time, you know, me taking somebody's photo in the street, or anybody doing that, you know, it's also not harming people. And I think that, you know, street photography has been a great medium throughout history of documenting the world in the realist sense. You know, there's no fakery there. This is the truth of what we're seeing. You know, I'm not manipulating anything. I'm not staging anything. This is the real world in all its beauty and all its ugliness. And I think that that's a very, very important thing that we need to maintain, because we live in an age of deception these days, in an age of smoke and mirrors, you know, where what you see isn't necessarily the reality of what the world is like. And people want to present themselves in a way that isn't always genuine to who they are and what their life is. And, you know, it's like they want you to perceive that the world is as it is when it's not. And street photography is one of the, you know, like, if you look back at any period of time, you'll get the greatest sense of what somewhere was actually like, what a culture was like, what an era was like, through the street photography and the photography, when it's completely real, unstaged. And I think that that's a very important thing that, for me as a photographer, I like to, you know, continue that tradition, you know, if that makes sense.
You definitely shoot film. I mean, that's, yes, you know, apparent. We can see it here. I mean, in fact, I think you have two IG accounts, one for film and one for digital, if I'm not mistaken. Now, you do have black and whites, obviously, and you do have color. I'm just curious, what's your mindset on the two? How do you decide which one you want to use to present an image?
I go through phases. there's times where I will just go out and just shoot black and white. I'll, you know, or I'll just shoot film, or I'll just shoot color. I think a lot of it comes down to sort of fatigue, mental fatigue. For example, like if I'm shooting color digital, like I hate editing. I hate doing any of that work after that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And it'll get to the point where I'll be like, I'll have memory cards full of photos that I haven't gone through. And I've got this backlog of images that I haven't edited. And I've got, you know, thousands of images. And I'm just like, ah, this is doing my head in. So I'll go and shoot black and white for a bit, because then there's basically very minimal, you know, editing in that process. And I like the look of black and white as well. And I think particularly for flash work, I prefer black and white to color more. I think it makes the images more striking. And then it might get to a point where I'm like, I'm like kind of a bit fatigued with shooting black and white. So I'll go and shoot film, but then I'll get to a point where I'm so sick of developing, because I do all my developing and scanning as well. So like I say, I kind of go through these cycles where I'll just like obsessively shoot film, obsessively shoot black and white, obsessively shoot color. And it's interesting, like I have a friend of mine, Alex Munoz, who's a photographer, street photographer also. He has a YouTube channel and he's based in Tokyo, and he will do I think like winter will always shoot black and white, and throughout the summer periods will always shoot color. So he literally will have it'll get to like November and he'll be like, right, no more color, no, I'm on black and white. You know, and it religiously will do that. You know, I don't know the exact dates or periods, but basically, yeah, he's very kind of methodical with it. Whereas I'm more like just I'll go through fits and changes, and then sometimes again, like it's just like you'll go with wherever the mood takes you. You know, I think, oh, I'm going out tonight, I'll grab a roll of cine still, and you know, just go and shoot one roll or something. You know, it's like there's no hard and fast rule. It's just you kind of go with your gut, or with when you get so annoyed with having to edit photos. You know.
I'm curious. So as a photographer for the last 5 years in Tokyo, have you ventured out of Tokyo? Have you photographed anywhere else? Have you traveled to go? Share with the listeners, what have you done in terms of photographing different places?
Obviously, for a few of those years, we couldn't really travel much because of the, you know, COVID. So it was definitely Tokyo was the heavy focus. But I've also done other cities in Japan. You know, I was down in Kyoto. I've been there a few times and taken some photos. And I mean, Tokyo is as well. I mean, I've barely even all those years, I've barely scratched the surface of it. It's so big. But the other place I've been a few times was I went to Hong Kong twice. And that's probably my favorite place that I've ever gone to photo. You know, and when I was back in the UK, I did a bit back there as well. But yeah, Hong Kong, because for me, like, you know, I grew up on a lot of Hong Kong cinema, a lot of the kind of old Shaw Brothers movies and you know, the old Kung Fu movies. And we used to have a guy that he had a van that would come up to our house. It was full of VHS tapes. It was like a video shop, video rental, but he'd have his van and it was all his own collection. He'd rent it out for like 50p a week basically, but it would be all like kind of classic kind of movies of the time, you know. And what was great is like we'd be about 12 or 13 and he'd let us get all the 18 movies out. He'd be like, oh, is it all right with your parents? We'd say yeah. So he had a lot of the old Kung Fu movies and things like Alien and Robocop, you know, all these things I shouldn't have been watching at that age. But anyway, I grew up on a lot of that Hong Kong cinema. And then when I got into shooting photography, like two artists that really stood out to me was Fan Ho, who's like arguably the most famous of all the kind of Hong Kong based photographers, who was shooting from the 1950s onwards. And a guy I call Greg Girard, who's a fellow Canadian. I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but he spent a lot of time in Hong Kong in the 70s, 80s, also Asia as a whole. And he shot a lot of Kowloon Wall City, which was this very densely packed, you know, building complex. And so, yeah, I was kind of fascinated by Hong Kong throughout my life, from even the photography, you know, like two of my favourites documented there religiously. So when I was drawn to it. So when I did go out there, it was a very kind of special place. I felt like I was kind of walking in the footsteps of giants, just to be in that culture. And yeah, it's way more dense than Tokyo, you know, in terms of it's almost like the buildings are much more claustrophobic and the older and a bit more kind of disheveled, and everywhere you look, it's just an amazing, you know, alleyway, or you know, just beautiful architecture. And and also there's a lot of life that goes on in the streets. And I say this to people, like in Japan there's billions of people everywhere, well, not billions obviously, but you know, there's millions of people running around the city, but they're always kind of going from A to B. So you're catching people in their suits running down the street trying to catch a train or whatever, whereas in other parts of Asia, people are just living on the streets. And I don't mean mean in a homeless sense. I mean, but like life happens in the streets. They're not always going from this point to this point. They're out on the street working their business or, you know, hanging out and stuff like that. And it's a very different experience. It's life is always happening around you in a way that it doesn't in Japan. If I don't know if that kind of makes sense, but it's definitely something that really drew me to Hong Kong. So yeah, Hong Kong to date, my favorite place I've ever photographed. So.
Have you ever come across a subject that you've taken the image, you know, you've gone home, let's say you're culling through your work, see what you did the day, right? And just kind of get it on the big screen and, you know, just really absorbing what you did, right? Has there ever been a time where you come across an image and you're like, wow, that's actually more impactful than I thought it would be? Have you ever come across an image where it struck a chord with you, almost bringing you to a tear sort of thing?
Yeah, I guess maybe one time I took this image. This was really early on. I know, again, people have very strong opinions about taking photos of homeless people, for example. Some people are like adamantly against it. But I had taken a photo of a homeless guy, but you couldn't really see his face. He was sat under a bridge, under an umbrella, and you could kind of see his body in a book. So I didn't feel it was any way exploitative because you couldn't really, you know, it's not like he was the main focus. But at the moment, these two chaps in suits walked past and they were like laughing out loud to themselves. Nothing to do with the guy, just in the conversation. But when I got back and I was looking at it to me felt quite striking because of the disparity between the guy, the homeless guy with his belongings, and the guys in this, you know, who's also reading, he's educating himself, you know, and the two guys who in the suits kind of just, it looked like, you know, like they weren't laughing at him, obviously, but just the balance of the two to me felt quite striking. But that was one that kind of jumped to my mind. But yeah, I'm sure there's others, but I can't think off the top of my head.
What's one thing that you hope viewers of your work take away from viewing your work? What is it that you hope to convey to a viewer?
I don't know, really. I never really think too deep about these things. Like I say, I think for me, it's just really everything, all my photography that I've taken so far, it's just, you know, part of the learning process. I hope that they can look at it and see, firstly, that there's some development there in terms of me as an artist, you know, like they look at that and say, oh yeah, he's progressing as a photographer, you know, he's getting better. That'd be cool. Like I said, I think, you know, if people look at it and get a sense of honesty, I would appreciate that, you know. That, you know, they feel that it's, you know, I'm not trying to say too much. I'm not trying to be political. I'm not trying to be anything like that. I'm just trying to, capture the world as I see it. And hopefully people look at the work and think it resonates with them on some level. That'd be cool. But, you know, like I say, it's entirely open for interpretation. You know, people can look into these and see what they want to see. But as long as they know that it comes from a place of passion and love.
I look at your feed and I can tell you right away that I can see you're growing because you know how I asked you before about like whether or not you take just candids or, you know, these portraitures that you've been taking that I see later, like just recently in your feed. I mean, this is telling me that, yeah, you are trying different things. Someone really looks carefully enough. You can tell a lot about the person that's posting to some degree.
I think so. Yeah.
You know, I'm looking at your feed now and there's actually a series. There was a post that you put up on October the 11th of 2023. And what I liked about this post was a couple of things. It was the color that, you know, were constant in these, I guess it's like a series of about a dozen, maybe just under a dozen images. And it's a festival. I mean, I can see the notes here and the colors are very consistent. You know, you've got a lot of blown out backgrounds. They are portraitures. The first image that really grabbed me was the first one there. The one that you see when you're looking at the feed of the individual. He's, you know, I guess, what do you call that? That robe that he's got on.
Yeah, yeah. It's a hoppy, it's called. It's the festival robes that they wear. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he's like some big Yakuza member.
Yeah, yeah. He looks like a big dude you don't want to mess with. He looks like a guy that, you know, he can just sit on you and he'd squash you like a bug.
He doesn't do it any justice. He was a big man, you know, like a powerful man. But yeah, that is, I can't remember what the name of the festival. I was just walking through Harajuku at the time. And these festivals, it's a Matsuri. And what they do is they'll have this huge, big shrine. I kind of, right now, I can't remember what they're called. But they basically carry it from one temple to another in the streets. And there's like, they do it all over the city. And they have huge events all over Japan where they do these Matsuris. They were all all part of the same kind of group, community group, basically. But they're all, I mean, the amount of like tattoos, a lot of Yakuza members basically in that group there. And he was definitely one of them for sure. But yeah, that was great. That I just recently got a Pentax 6.7 at the time, which is a medium format film camera with a 105 f2.4 lens, which is a kind of legendary portrait lens. So I was just out testing that out really for the day. Big beast of a camera to carry around. And so I think that guy, I think I may have asked him to take his photo. I didn't want to do a candid of him.
I can understand why.
Yeah, yeah. Some of the other ones were certainly candid.
Yeah, well, I mean, listen, that's and I can see you've got it here in the description, Pentax 6.7. You didn't mention the 105, but I can see whether, I can definitely see this is a 105 on the compression alone. And you're using Fuji 400, the 400H, which is a beautiful film stock.
Yeah, still got a few rolls of that tucked away for a rainy day.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this one was taken with the Fuji or the Portra, because you do mention here in the post that it's a combination of the two, but I don't think this is Portra if I'm looking at it. I mean, I don't know. You could have done something to it in post, but this looks more Fuji tone to me.
Yeah, I think it is. I think that was the Fuji, yeah. Yeah, I think so.
You know, it's got the more coolish look to it.
Yeah, 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 for sure.
You know, that's typically what Fuji is, right? They're more on the cooler side than Kodak's usually on the warmer side. It's, well, at least that's the way it's always been to my recollection. But yeah, these are great images. Pentax 6.7, I mean, that, you know, that's legendary, that camera.
It's just great, isn't it?
I mean, that thing is just legendary when it comes to images. It's unfortunate that it's so damn heavy.
I had a RB67 that I sold in order to get that. And it's funny, but I'd say I'm getting a Pentax 6.7 and people are like, oh, it's a, you know, you've got to have some muscles to carry that thing around. I remember thinking, it's like, you've clearly never wandered around with an RB all day, because that's a whole other level. The Pentax, and well, you know, if you get the grip handle on it, it's absolutely fine. But
still, I mean, that wooden handle... That adds more weight to it.
It does, but it's just, you know, it just hangs nicely there, you know. So it's, yeah, I don't mind it. I mean, a friend of mine, he just recently, when he was over here, he found a good deal on a Mamiya 7.2 with the 80mm lens. You know, it's very expensive, very kind of coveted camera, but because the yen is so cheap to the dollar, he's from the US, he got a great price on it. Another friend commented and he was like, oh, you know, that's the best medium format camera. I still don't think it can touch the Pentax, when, you know, the 105 for portraits is just unbelievable. The separation is like, it's unlike, it's the closest you'll get to large format from a medium format camera.
What are film prices like there?
Yeah, horrible, extortionate. I mean, we pay more here. Like, I tend to get my film from the US shipped over because it's so much cheaper. But yeah, it's the pricing is terrible and availability is very difficult. And I mean, that's one of the things that kind of, it's sad really about Japan, because it has such an amazing culture of photography, but the film is extortionate. It's hard to get. The labs aren't the best out here either. You know, like the scans aren't the best. So, you know, I tend to do everything myself really.
I would not have guessed that. Like, I would have thought that Japan, wow.
Yeah, you'd think so, wouldn't you? That's the thing. You think so, but I mean, when I was out in Hong Kong, the labs out there were so much better. And they could also do ECN2 film stocks. So, because, you know, I like to shoot motion picture film in 35mm. So the Kodak Vision 3 stocks. And you can't do it over here in Japan because they won't develop it. There's literally, like, it's almost, I think it's illegal for them to do it. So no, you can't get it developed.
Wow, I've got like 4 labs around me that can do it.
I wish we could do it.
I could even do it myself. In fact, I have ECN2 developer right here, right now. I have 3 pouches. It's not hard to do.
No, but that's it. You can't.
The problem is it takes time, right? I like to do my own developing. There are those times that I'm like, you know, I don't have time to spend a Sunday doing this. I'm just going to, you know, bite the bullet and pay the money to get it developed. Johnny, thanks so much for joining me here on the Street Photography Show podcast. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, it's been great. It's been fun.
Where can our listeners go to see your work and reach out to you if they have any questions? Would you mind sharing that?
Of course, yeah. Well, the easiest place is obviously Instagram, and you can find me there. It's at Johnny Dubb. It's J-O-N-N-Y and then D-U-B, all one word. And then there's also Johnny Dubb Shoots Film, which is my analog one. And that's probably the easiest place, but I do have a website, but I'm very terrible at updating it, but that's johnnydub.net. You know, if anybody from here who's listening to this comes over there, you know, drop me a little message and I'd love to say hello. And, you know, obviously if you want to talk about photography, I'm always down for it as well. I could talk about it for days, you know, it's just fun, isn't it?
And we'll have the links in the show notes below so our listeners can easily access that. Not a problem.
Yeah, thank you. And again, if anybody ever out in, you know, heading out to Tokyo, be sure to reach out as well. You know, we love, there's a nice community here. We love linking up with people and talking about photography and going out and taking photos and all this kind of stuff. So again, you know, it's a very open, welcoming community over here. So yeah, if anybody's in the area, be sure to reach out. And same goes for yourself. Yeah, if you're ever out in this way, yeah, then let us know and we can go and get some food and take some photos.
If you enjoyed the show, please remember to follow and highly rate the show, as it allows me to continue creating more content for you, my awesome listeners. Also, don't forget to join us next week as new episodes are added on Fridays. Until next time, keep walking and keep clicking. This is Mark Rossi. Bye for now.